Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Ted Russin is a man of science. He's also an artist, a man of food. From basketball-sized souffles to gravy balls that bounce, he can turn Frankenstein-like laboratory creations into culinary delights. All it takes, you know, is a little science. Now, Ted is the Associate Dean of Culinary Science at the Culinary Institute of America. Prior to joining the Culinary Institute, he was a research scientist for CP Kelco in San Diego, where he was responsible for food product development. He was also previously a research chemist for the Canadian government's Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada Agency. So if he's good enough to work for Canada, he's good enough to be on the show. He has a master's degree in food science and agricultural chemistry. He's also a star of a pilot called Geekalicious on the Cooking Channel, where he whipped up things like a trampoline dessert and food that glows in the dark. And of course he did, and we'll talk about that. So let's get down to the science of food. Give us a call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us online. You can post your questions and comments on the Vox Pop page of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You can post on Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. There's a Vox Pop post there. You can tweet us at WAMC Radio with the hashtag Vox Pop, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. We do love your numbers, though, the phone calls, that is, 1-800-348-2551. It's a long introduction. Dr. Strangelove, welcome back to the program.
Ray, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
So you did this show, and you did it a couple of years ago. It was a pilot for the Cooking Channel, and we didn't know about this the first time you were on. Mm-hmm. And it was Geekalicious, and you made a trampoline dessert and food that glows in the dark. And frankly, we can't let another moment go by without talking about food that glows in the dark.
Well, it was a while ago. It was back in 2011. I shot this pilot for the Cooking Channel. It was kind of interesting. I'd started initially with another pilot, which was designed to make supersized foods.
What do you mean supersized
foods?
Well,
this pilot actually was called Megabytes. That didn't end up working out for me. But the team that was sort of led that pilot built a 10,000-pound Rice Krispie treat.
Okay, and to what end?
It was a fundraiser. So the idea was that we build this 10,000-pound Rice Krispie treat, and then we cut it into pieces, and we sort of get donations for these pieces, and people can eat part of a 10,000-pound Rice Krispie.
Now, it doesn't strike me that there would be a great deal of science involved with that, right? Maybe physics, keeping the structural integrity, but other than that, it's just a big Rice Krispie treat, right?
Well, you know, it's there. You got to keep it safe. You got to make sure people don't get sick. You got to build a pan big enough to hold 10,000 pounds.
Yeah, sure.
You also need to ensure that it doesn't crush. Like, I've never sort of stacked up that many Rice Krispies, but think about the physics that you've got the little Rice Krispie at the bottom, and then you have the Rice Krispie at the top. You have 10,000 pounds on top of it.
Right.
There's a structural issue there.
So presumably, if it's big enough, mm-hmm. the Rice Krispies on the bottom mm-hmm. could, in fact, perform some sort of fusion and explode?
That would be, it would be no longer crispy, probably.
No. Good point. Well, I got to say, the phone lines are loaded, but I need to know this glow-in-the-dark food. What's all this about?
Well, it's, okay, so glow-in-the-dark is just a certain type of, it's essentially a type of fluorescence.
Right.
And there are many chemical compounds that fluoresce.
Right.
So essentially what happens is they pull in energy at a particular frequency of light.
Okay.
And then they release that same energy at a different frequency. So what happens with a fluorescing element or a fluorescing molecule,
yep.
it will pull in this energy, and then you shine a different frequency and it'll glow. So when it comes to food, there's a range of fluorescing molecules and a range of fluorescing ingredients. And the one that's the most easily accessible would be quinine, which is the bittering ingredient that you find in tonic water.
Sure.
So if you were to just take straight real tonic water and put a black light on it, you would see that it would glow blue.
I'll be darned.
So we used that, and we created a vest that you could put on yourself. It was in the heyday of, if we remember, Lady Gaga made her sort of meat dress.
Yeah, delicious.
So it was inspired by that. So the notion of edible clothing was what we were playing with, and we ultimately created a vest, a snazzy vest, that would glow in the dark under proper black light.
So you take it to the disco.
Yeah, think about it.
You dance under the black light, mm-hmm. and then you have a snack.
Well, if you're hungry, like you gotta power through that rave, right?
Right, of course.
So
of course.
Could theoretically just eat yourself. You could sort of survive by eating your own clothing.
Okay, this is taking a disturbing turn. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Ted Russin today, Associate Dean of Culinary Science at CIA. Let's go to Thomas and Troy. Thomas, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering what makes people have different palates for their food tastes. Does that make sense?
I guess you're saying what is one man's caviar is another man's salty, fishy sort of thing.
Well put.
Is that sort of how we sort of all have different preferences with regards to foods?
Okay.
Well, we all live, and there's a lot of research being done recently in terms of flavor perception. And there's first and foremost the actual food itself. So there's various chemicals there that we ingest and we solubilize. We basically get it into our body through chewing, and it gets into the saliva, or we breathe it in through our nose. So we perceive that those chemicals, and those chemicals don't change. But we are all individual snowflakes out there, and we all live in sort of our own genetic world, and we have certain particular genetic predispositions to flavors, aromas, and tastants. And the more research that's being done recently is it's showing that people are much more varied than we think, and that you may have something like cilantro, an herb that to some people is delicious and super, super Thai and Mexican flavored, and it's the greatest thing I've ever eaten. And then to other people, it tastes like soap.
Yeah.
And that would be linked to the particular genetic mutation that people have. And so those types, if you start thinking about the amount of DNA that we have in our cells and the amount of DNA that sort of builds us as individuals, there's a lot of room for variation. And so I think with regards to that, all those possibilities, what we'll find is that ultimately we may agree on some flavors, but I think there'll probably be more disagreement than agreement.
Amazing. Thomas, thanks a lot for the call. Now, are the mutants the one who like cilantro or the ones who don't like cilantro?
You know, I don't discriminate amongst people. So, you know, we can all either choose to agree to disagree. How about that? And cilantro may be good for some.
That's a cop-out, though.
Well,
that's a
you know, I enjoy cilantro.
Okay, so and clearly you're a mutant.
Well,
so.
I guess that's
all right, let's go to Layla in Mount Tremper. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious about the origins of red velvet cake. Nowadays, it's popular, especially around Valentine's Day, and it's a chocolate cake with a reddish color, which I think now is done with food dye. But I believe it originally evolved through some reaction with a leavening agent with the cocoa in the cake, and it naturally turned a reddish color. I wonder if that's correct, and if so, if you could explain why that happened.
You know, Layla, thanks for your question. Red velvet cake is everywhere.
Yes.
You know, there's cupcakes.
Yeah.
Is the red velvet. People are dressing up in red velvet motifs. So it is everywhere and everything. And I think you're correct, Layla, that nowadays people just use red food coloring to get the color that they want. So it's the little red tincture, red number 40, that people end up dropping in their cakes. With regards to the question of whether leavening agents had an effect, you know, that's a good question. I do know, say, for example, Devil's Food Cake. If you look at Devil's Food Cake, it's really, really dark. And one of the reasons for that is if you start looking at the recipes, there's an amount of baking soda present, and then there's an acid of some sort, whether it's buttermilk or whatever it may be, or molasses or something like that. And in Devil's Food Cake, you have more soda than you really need to leaven the cake. And the reason it's there is because it changes the pH of the batter, and it makes it more alkaline. And alkalinized cocoa is darker. So when you start looking at the different types of cocos you could buy in the grocery store, the darker ones are actually, if you pulled out your handy-dandy pH meter, you'd find that it's probably a pH 9, 10, or 11, which is pretty alkaline. Bleach is pH 12. So I think I can certainly vouch for Devil's Food Cake. With regards to Red Velvet Cake, I'd have to sort of think about it. Perhaps it's more of an acidic cake that it's just not as dark a cocoa. Perhaps.
So there is cocoa in true red velvet.
Well, you know, I've long struggled with red velvet cake myself because I've had very good ones and I've had very, very bad ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, right now the whole hip and groovy new thing is to use natural colorants or pigments and dyes from actual foods. So you would go and get some red beet juice and use that to color
that
your
taste, make the taste.
Well,
different?
From on sort of a commercial level, or industrial level, you can actually get red beet juice extract, which doesn't have any flavor.
Ah.
But if you start thinking about a cake and you have a whole bunch of sugar, you got a whole bunch of fat, you got it's leavened, so it's diluted with air bubbles. I think a little bit of beet juice would go a long way for giving you the color you want.
Layla, thanks a lot for the call. We're joined today by Ted Russin of the Culinary Institute. He's Associate Dean of Culinary Science. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. So you mentioned devil's food cake, having too much soda, and it being a pH issue. So we talked about this last time, and devil's food cake's been around a long time.
Yes.
Long before people like you investigated the science behind the whole thing. How did it come to be that they said, oh, we'll put more soda in this and it'll get...
You know, I have a feeling, I get a sense, and this we've had conversations in our department and at the Culinary Institute in general about the origins of food. So who was the first person to make cheese?
Right.
Right? How did that happen? The story that I hear is that they used sheep's stomachs or calves' stomachs to hold milk long time ago. And then in the sheep's stomach and in the calf's stomach, there's rennin, which is an enzyme, which actually is used in cheese making. It causes the casein to precipitate and make a curd.
Ah.
So you kind of go, well, I got my stomach pouch. I have some weird curdled milk in there. I would actually ask, who was the first person that actually tasted that?
Somebody was really, really desperate.
Really sort of, one of those early adopters, let's call them that. They're the ones with the iPhone 6 and the calf stomach.
Right, you
milk.
Are. I get it.
So with regards to that, I think perhaps what could have possibly happened is that before we had industrial cocoa production, we could potentially have had somebody just put too much soda in a cake and realize that it doesn't taste too alkaline, it doesn't taste too metallic. It's actually quite delicious in a deep chocolate flavor.
Ted Russin is our guest. Zach, the engineer, let's take a break here. We'll get back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551.
Comes from Spirit House Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world, wine tastings Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future, preservenys.org. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. And the Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, presenting the American Roots series at the Linda presents Charlie Parr, Sunday at 8 p.m., thelinda.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Guess what? It's Food Friday. And we welcome back our old friend Ted Russin, who is Associate Dean of Culinary Science at the Culinary Institute of America. All right, Ted, here's an email from Mark. Good afternoon, it starts. It seems like regardless of age, race, nationality, or socioeconomic level, all kids love pizza, and many adults too. Why is pizza so addictive? Great question, Mark.
Mark, thank you for your email. That's great. Actually, if I'm going to be completely transparent,
yeah,
I just had a piece of pizza.
Aha!
Yeah. Jeff and I sort of were zooming up here to the CIA, and we didn't have much time, so I just scarfed down a piece of pizza.
It's good stuff.
So to that end, it was delicious. I'll tell you that. I think pizza, and I've had these conversations with some of the chefs at the college, that pizza is sort of a layering of umami flavor or tastant. It's like an umami bomb. Okay, so you have, first and foremost, you have your dough, which is a dough. It's a carrier, for lack of a better term. However, you have the brown flavors and the brown crust. Okay, so you're developing these Maillard flavors on the exterior of the crust, which is, like, as we know, baked bread has a richness in the crust. So that umami flavoring there. Then you put tomatoes, cooked tomatoes on, which, again, is a source of umami glutamates present there. Pile on top of that some cheese, and cheese is basically aged. We started with a discussion of cheese. Cheese is essentially aged milk, and you get the development of glutamates in that. As the cheese ages, more and more proteins are broken down to form these umami tastants. Put on top of that some fermented meat, pepperoni. I know not for the vegetarians in the crowd, but put some pepperoni on there, which is a fermented meat. Again, we're getting glutamates and fermentation breakdown products. And essentially what you have is just umami. That's what you have.
So it's like a drug.
Well, it is a, we have, umami is a basic tastant. We need that. There's sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. And this is something that we need. And evolutionarily speaking, we have a certain requisite for particular amino acids. And it's hypothesized that the reason we have this predisposition to umami is because we need particular amino acids. And so, you know, don't feel bad when you eat pizza because you're just satisfying a basic evolutionary need.
Is there such a thing, and we hear this term bandied about everywhere, oh, so-and-so's a comfort food.
Mm.
Is there such a thing as a true food that will bestow peace and tranquility upon someone?
Well, you know, going back to our original caller, Thomas, about the sophisticated palate, where we discuss sort of this different genetic world that we all live in when it comes to flavor perception, I think that the notion of comfort food probably is couched more so in terms of cultural cues as opposed to something that's essential all across the planet. Maybe it is pizza. I don't know. Probably not. But this idea of comfort, I think, is couched. Ray, what's your favorite food?
That's a subjective thing. This is Timothy Leary's subjective universe. Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking about an objective effect of something that would make it a quote-unquote comfort food.
Well, when you eat a food, there's certain things that happen. I know that you're low on blood sugar, so you get blood sugar. Glucose enters your body, so you feel better. Particular amino acids, you get satiated. Your tummy gets full, and you have this feeling of satiety. All these things are happening and they make you feel better, generally speaking. But I think, you know, if I was to give you a definition of a comfort food, it would probably be something that my mother made many years ago.
Okay, so that's society and that's you personally and your memories and everything.
My mom's roast chicken's awesome.
Oh yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. She's it's awesome.
Okay, so here's another email. This is from Brendan in Port Ewan. What is the scientific definition of food? What differentiates a hockey puck from a pancake? See, which seemed to be a rather simple one.
Well, as being a Canadian, I appreciate the hockey puck, the hockey puck metaphor there, or comparison. You know, that's a good question because I would argue that biomolecules are essentially food, no matter what.
Okay.
So, for example, one of the things I do in one of my classes, I teach a class in ingredient functionality, which is a class about what are our ingredients and what do they do for us. And I talk to the students about cellulose.
Mm.
And cellulose is a material that can be used. You see it in different foods as a thickening agent. And the students, I tell them that it comes from wood. And the students are taken aback a little bit. And I say, well, you have to eat 28 grams of wood a day because you got to eat 20 grams of fiber. Right? We need that to basically scrape and clean out our system.
Sure.
And so the question as to what constitutes a food, I think, really, if we start thinking about biomolecules, proteins, lipids, carbohydrates, small minerals, vitamins, phytonutrients, those types of things, I think they are all food. Now, not all biomolecules are nutritive. So if you were to go, you know, I remember being in elementary school telling my friends that you could eat grass and survive on eating grass, which is not true.
Okay.
But it was fun to have my friends eat grass.
That's right? Nice.
So there are biomolecules that you can ingest that won't help you and that are poisonous and all these other things. But I would say a hockey puck, which is basically made from synthetic rubber,
yeah,
which is basically a petroleum distillate,
yeah,
I would not eat a hockey
puck.
No,
that would not be a good meal.
I wouldn't do that, but a pancake could be delicious.
All right, fine. I think we've sorted that out. Dr. Yes. Fred in Glens Falls. Dr. Fred, you're up.
Yeah, it's so fun being towards the end of the line here because so many ideas go in your head from what you hear and you don't know what to say. You're in your own pirate show. I do, anyhow. Hey, listen, first of all, you were Mr. Neon, and then I heard your name being called Ted. And I know you were out there in San Diego where Disneyland is and 75 degree weather is perfect. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, Disneyland's in Anaheim, but San Diego's very nice.
Well, yeah, but I heard it all. So I want to thank you for coming back to the Four Seasons, get it, quote, unquote,
of
New York and New England to do whatever you're doing because the Four Seasons give you the opportunity for imagination of changes. And then here's a funny, okay? I heard you being introduced at first as Dr. Neon.
Dr. Neon? No.
Neon.
No, I don't think so.
Well, how did you introduce...
I said hello. I called him Dr. Strangelove at the beginning of the show.
Oh,
when I just said hi. But that's for Mad Scientist. He blew up some things.
Oh, then you talked about Timothy Leary. That was pretty interesting. But so welcome back to the Northeast. And I'm a Necky person from Vermont. And
right,
I just celebrate your Rearrival. I thought I heard something about neon and food and devil's
cake. Okay, let's just do the Cliff Notes version of this, and then we'll move on.
Yes, we have foods that fluoresce in the dark, so they glow in the dark.
Okay, so what happened for me is I was looking at my aquarium, and I have neon fish in there. I'm going to scoop them out and have them an appetizer for my dinner tonight.
You know, you don't want to eat Fluffy. Fluffy's kept you company in many a time.
Yeah.
But yes, there are even jellyfish fluoresce in under ultraviolet light.
Well, Dr. Fred, thank you for that. And 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Let's go to Andrew in Rhinebeck. Hiya, Andrew, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I'm a microbiologist, and of course, fermentation products are my favorite, as you can imagine.
I love having a good
glass of red wine. Mm-hmm. And why does red wine, like a good Cabernet, why does it pair so well with dark chocolate? I mean, the nuances of that are just incredible. I was at a wine tasting at the CIA a number of years ago when we were sampling all this sorts of stuff in one of the lecture halls, and that's the first time that it really hit me to mix that or have that combination of things. And do you know exactly, is it just the tannins in the wine followed by some compounds in chocolate that really make this a great match?
Well, Andrew, thanks for the question. I'm glad to hear that you're coming out to the CIA to do tastings. We do all kinds of things like that, so there's all kinds of food enthusiast programming at the college, so that's
great
to hear.
It's a great place. It's the jewel in the Hudson Valley.
The jewel in the Hudson Valley. It's a diamond shining. So to that point, then, your question about red wines and dark chocolate. Now, there's a couple things, and I know you said you're a microbiologist, I feel for you. I'm sorry that you decided on that career path,
because I'm a chemist.
But anyways, and all microbiology is ultimately chemistry. But anyways, let's not belabor that. So the idea of a Cab Sauvignon. So you're saying a really deep red wine coming from the Napa Valley, something like that. It's really strongly flavored. We of course have the tannins, but we have a lot of acid. We have sort of rich aromatics that come with that, and dark chocolate as well is highly alkaline, and you have and chocolate is a fermentation product as well, and you have sort of I would suggest, and I don't know exactly the reason they pair so well, but I would surmise or speculate that you have a highly acidic beverage, highly flavorful beverage that can, those flavors can carry through the sensory experience, and then you have chocolate, which is softer, which is creamier, which is more alkaline, and these two things are coming together, and you have this sort of synergy or at least complementary experience there. And I think it's the combination of the acids, the tannins, the liquid, the solid, the deep flavors of both of those things. I think if you paired it with a white wine, you'd probably lose all the nuance of the white wine if you had followed it with a chocolate or dark chocolate.
Oh, I would agree with you. My thought was always that, you know, when you're eating the chocolate first, of course, that it does something. It coats the tongue, the taste buds on the tongue, and then along comes this this beverage, this red wine, and for some reason it's picking up on the materials that are still attached to the taste buds on the tongue, and it's just a fascinating thing.
I think that makes sense, and really chocolate has fat in it, and wine doesn't, so you have this, fat is not particularly soluble in the mouth, and then you have the liquid coming in, which is water, basically, so you have this emulsion being formed in the mouth and the manner in which it coats and passes by your taste buds. I think there's a lot going there, but let's not forget the aromas that you're, of course, coming through your nose, and retronasal aromas, which are coming when you sort of breathe out, that come from the back end, that go through the back of your nose. So there's a lot.
Absolutely.
But the one thing that we could rest assured is that it's just a symphony in your mouth, and that's what's the most important thing, really.
Andrew, thanks so much for the call. 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Professor Ted Russin, Associate Dean of Culinary Science at the Culinary Institute of America. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Always a fascinating program when Ted's on. David in New Paltz. David.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job.
Thank you.
I have a question about salt. Okay. My favorite salt is a Namak.
Okay.
Namak salt. It's a salt from India.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I know salt is sodium chloride, but they also have in this salt like a sulfur. Mm-hmm. And it also has a, when it's added to food, it has a wonderful taste. And there's also a black salt from Hawaii, a mm-hmm. volcanic salt, mm-hmm. and a Himalayan pink salt, mm-hmm. and there's a lemon salt that's yellow, and I wondered if you could comment about these salts chemically.
Yeah, David, thanks. That's a good question, and I think that's actually, you're onto something here. I think that's a very popular now to have these different salts. And in the manufacture of salt, it depends on the salt bed from which you're extracting this. Essentially, you have saline solutions that are evaporated in the sun, and in some cases, it can be clearly very well refined, where you get white salt. But in other cases, you could have, I've seen the pink salts, I've heard of sort of these salt, the sulfury salts, and these different types of salts. And they really, as I understand them, and we got to make a differentiation between sort of strongly flavored salts that you can clearly sort of perceive these differences, as versus other salts that I have looked at a little bit of research in there. People have been saying they've done sort of blind tastings with different salts, and they've come to see that in some cases there aren't any different perceived flavors amongst these salts.
Huh.
So it's an interesting sort of a field of research right now, but I can tell you that there are definitely some salts that the manner in which they're refined and the manner in which they're dried, others, I don't want to say the term contaminants, but definitely other materials that are present during the dehydration process can affect their appearance and ultimately their flavor. So I think you're onto that. And these salts, if anything, I would use them as finishing salts as opposed to cooking salts. So I would use them to garnish so that you can have that flavor for top, right, and center. You don't want to use something, a very sort of flavorful salt, as a cooking salt. Say you're cooking pasta or something like that. You don't want to use it there. You want to use it as a finishing salt at the end of the dish.
Okay, so salt basically is salt. Mm-hmm. Things that are added to the salt give it the texture.
Well,
or included with.
Sodium chloride is going to be there no matter what. And I would basically, and I have to do a little bit of work on this, kind of reading on this, because I've heard that there have been some tests done where they really weren't. If you didn't know it, you wouldn't tell the difference.
Uh-huh.
But because it's marketed in a particular way, because it's packaged in a certain way, even because it's, the color of it is a certain way, you think there's a difference there too. And again, we're just mere humans eating this stuff, so we have our biases.
Ted Russin is our guest. It's Vox Pop. It is a Food Friday. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Rachel in Plattsburgh. Hi, Rachel. You're on.
Hi. My question was about the chemical composition of like artificial sweeteners and why they taste sweet.
That's a great question, Rachel. That's a huge topic. No matter what, there are chemists that spend their whole career studying aspartame and discussing that, or sucralose. I can speak with regards to, say, sucralose, for example, which goes under the trademark of Splenda.
Right, and I would say that's probably one of the more common ones nowadays.
Absolutely, it's there. It's out there. Sucralose actually is basically sucrose, but instead of the hydrogens that are present there, they are replaced with chlorine atoms. So it's got the same physical shape, but the molecule is slightly bigger because chlorine atoms are bigger than hydrogen atoms. The shape of the molecule is very similar to sucrose, and that molecule fits into your sweet perceptors in such a way that your body is telling you that you're eating something that's sweet. Unfortunately, the chlorine molecules are so big, or chlorine atoms are so big, that when you ingest the Splenda, your enzymes that actually sort of would break down sucrose, sucralase, it would break it down, and it would just break it into constituents, glucose and fructose. Because chlorine is present there, your enzymes can't get to it, and they can't break it down, so it just passes through your body. It just passes through your body like everything else passes through your body. I won't go into the graphic details of that.
No, please don't.
So it has a lot to do with the physical conformation of the molecule and how it fits into your particular receptors in your body. A lot of flavor perception has to do with the shape of the molecule as opposed to its composition. So think of it as a lock and key. Your keys will only open particular locks. And
so is it the inability of the body to break it down that causes it to be calorie free?
Yeah, exactly. So it's called non-nutritive. So your body just can't get to it physically. Mm. There are other compounds that are also similar in that way. Olestra, which was sort of a fiasco of the food science.
No, why was it a fiasco?
Well, it was a fat replacer.
Yes, I remember
and
this.
It was used. You would deep fry potato chips in it, and this fat would not be susceptible to lipase, which is an enzyme in your body, so it would pass through you, so it would be non-nutritive, so you wouldn't be able to extract the calories from the chemical bonds present in the molecule. However, if you think of an oil passing through anything,
there were some issues.
It would sort of pass with you. It would lubricate many things with your body.
Fair enough. Okay, yes. Well, Rachel, that's probably more than you needed to know, but thank you. goodbye, I suppose. So why is it that some artificial sweeteners, for lack of a better term, are sweeter than others? For instance, I drink diet soda a lot. Mm-hmm. My wife won't touch the stuff. If she sips mine by mistake, she says, oh, God, that's too sweet. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, well, that's splendid. Tastes great. Tastes just like Coke to me. Mm-hmm. So why is it that to some people it just seems way too sweet?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I was... You look like you drink diet soda as well, very svelte.
You know what? Thanks. And that's like, why we have you back.
We're on the radio here, yeah. but believe me.
Wow.
So I think there's something to that. I know that, say, aspartame, which is the sweetener system, aspartame and ACE-K, sulfame, potassium, in diet soda, like a Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi, those systems are perceived a particular way. And I've actually had anecdotal conversations with people that initially they taste it and they hate it, but if you just sort of jam it down your throat enough, you get used to it.
So what why do you think that happens?
I don't know. I think we build up a tolerance for these things and an expectation. And then when you go back to full sugar soda, you perceive it as extremely sweet. So I think it's, again, it kind of gets back to, I'm glad that Thomas sort of started this conversation about sort of our individual sort of perception, realms of perception when it comes to food.
Yeah.
I think that that's part of the game as well, that you have a particular preference for this, or you've at least built up a tolerance and a perception for this. Now, when you drink a full sugar soda, what happens? Do you like it?
Oh,
do you
I
find
love it
too sweet? Or
no, I think it's less sweet.
Really?
In other words, but I like Splenda more than I would... I try to avoid aspartame mm-hmm. just for the taste. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about the chemicals. Mm-hmm. For instance, when you go to Maine and you get a Diet Coke, mm-hmm. They all come with Splenda, at least last summer when we were up there. And so here, they're all whatever, aspartame. Or, yeah. So I prefer Splenda to that.
Well, you know, there was a time back in my early years when I was working in the lab and using sucralose. And you can get pure sucralose. The sucralose that you get in the yellow packets is cut.
Yeah.
With maltodextrin, which is a nutritive sort of just a neutral sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have this stuff pure, it's if you open it up the wrong way and it gets in the air and you sort of breathe it, you're going to be tasting sweet for like 3 days.
Really?
It's that potent.
All right, let's take a break here. Ted Russin is our guest, 1-800-348-2551, or Dr. Neon, whatever you want to call him. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Sundog Solar at Solaqua Power and Art, Chatham, New York. Making power from sunlight, solar, electric, and solar hot water sales and leasing, spray foam, and cellulose insulation, spin your meter backwards, sundogsolar.net. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, opening the 2015 spring season with Ellen McLaughlin's modern adaptation of The Trojan Women, Euripides' classical Greek tragedy. Through Sunday, newpaltz.edu/theatre for tickets. Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce, offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. UpstateDivorceMediation.com. And Gloversville Sewing Center, Gloversville and Saratoga Springs, New York. A quilt shop offering Bernina and Janome sewing machines. GloversvilleSewingCenter.com. We're worth the trip.
Vox Pop, it's Food Friday on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Ted Russin is our guest. Ted is the Associate Dean of Culinary Science at CIA. Always an interesting guest here. And here are a few that came in via, looks like email and from the website. This one's from the website. No Name Given asks, I love cooking sous vide and would do it a lot more often if my wife wasn't convinced that the process bathes the food in chemicals from the plastic. Is there any current research into this, or is there anything I can tell her that might ease her mind, or is she right?
Well, No Name, it's a pleasure for you to hear your question. The reality is if you're going to be doing sous vide, and sous vide cooking, let's just make sure everybody's on the same page. Sous vide cooking is a particular style of contemporary cuisine where you take foods, you package them under vacuum, so you remove the atmospheric pressure, so you drop the pressure within the bag with a vacuum sealer, and then you seal, that seals, and then it goes into a water bath at a particular temperature. So you may say, I enjoy my steaks cooked to 62 degrees Celsius, and I will set my water bath at 62 degrees Celsius, and I will put my packaged meat into the water bath and hold it at that, and then leave it there until the whole thing hits 62, which takes a couple hours.
Okay.
Depending on the size of the piece of material, the type of food that you're cooking. You can cook anything that way. You can cook vegetables, you can cook eggs, you can cook everything that way. And a lot of culinarians are doing that now because the ability to control precisely the temperature and ultimately the sensory experience is key.
Yeah, but for how long? Until you have one bite and then it cools down? And
well, that is true. That is true. And actually, Ray, that's very insightful because I've had conversations with different chefs that are actually working the line, working in restaurants, where they'll be like, I cooked my steak to 62. It was perfect. I put it on a warm dish, but by the time it gets to the client, it's already cooled down to the point where they send it back and they say it's cold.
Yeah.
And if you were doing it traditionally on a saute pan or in an oven, you would come out sort of screaming hot, and then by the time it got the customer, it may have cooled down to a point where it'd be easily eaten and enjoyed. So that is a good point. So it's almost like you got to eat your piece of food right out of the bath.
Or
right
a very small piece of food.
Or a really small piece of food.
So a very expensive sort of high-end restaurant where you only get a tiny bit of food.
Yes.
Perfect.
So with regards to that, so the question has to do with you're putting the food in a plastic bag and putting it in a water bath. Is this a problem?
Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, I would say suggest using food-grade plastics. They are designed to be able to withstand oil and water degradation. So they are designed so that there aren't any chemicals that are leached into the food or leached out of the plastic. So they're designed for that. That's the first thing I would suggest. Using something like a Ziploc bag or something like that, they're not designed for this type of stuff.
Mm.
That would be sort of the first thing I would suggest. The other thing I'm going to say is you could theoretically use glass if you wanted to. I've had some chefs use, you know, mason jars to do this, which is just basically, if you think of canning, you kind of basically do that as well. You do it in making jam, you do it in a pressure cooker. So this could be a comparable, similar situation like that. But if you're using food-grade plastics, there is no evidence that there's any sort of strange phthalates or BPA or anything that's been leached into food. Relatively easy to analyze that, and I've yet to hear anything or see anything like that. But please use food-grade plastics for that.
Okay, and so apparently No Name Given's wife is wrong. That's the bottom line.
I am not a marriage counselor, so they have to work that out.
Fair enough. Ted Russin is our guest, and we'll get back to the phones in 1 minute. A lot of email here, so we'll do one more. Can you speak to the pros and cons of the Whole 30 plan?
Do you
know what that is? Yeah, nope. Whole 30.
Like whole H-O-L-E or W-H-O-L-E?
W-H-O-L-E, no space, 30.
I don't know. It sounds great, though.
It does sound great. Yeah. And let's move on then. Ron and Colony. Ron, you're up.
Hey Ray, I'm not going to give your guest a hard time because I really like this guy.
Wow, consider yourself lucky, Ted.
Hey, I'm
learning something new because it's a different take on everything.
Yeah,
it is.
I just want to hear your opinion. I don't know if you're aware or know who Dr. David Jubb is.
No,
but he talks a lot about the allostatic taste change, and the other one is chronobiotic nutrition, which is eating, which I think you've already kind of mentioned, is eating according to how the sun hits the ground. In other words, you eat from the top of the tree, then you eat like the berries, and then underneath the ground, which would be the carrots at night. Are you aware of either of these two concepts and your take on them?
I'm not aware of that. That's an interesting sort of perspective on things. I could easily see that there could be a movement or a food movement that would
that be a philosophical movement or science-based?
Yeah, you know, there's a range of different types.
This is science.
Yeah, I actually haven't heard anything about that. But, you know, ultimately what we want to do we want to eat all the plant if we can. So I think that is actually, no matter how we sort of get to that, whether it is sort of eating through altitude and its proximity to the sun, ultimately what we want to be is as respectful as we possibly can to be to the animals and to the plants that have provided us with this nourishment. So whatever that takes, I think, is sort of key to it.
Hey, Ron, I got to say something. Whatever the topic, you have the most out there call of them all, my brother.
Nice.
Well done. Let's go to Willie in Schenectady. Willie, you're on. Hey, Willie, turn the radio down, babe. You got to go. All right, let's go to Stephanie in Phoenicia. Stephanie.
Hi, it's actually Bethany.
Bethany, sorry.
It's okay. So going back to the Splenda, I just am not really clear. I've been, you know, I've read articles for years about Splenda and aspartame and how it has negative effects on the body, and just that, you know, you can't break it down, so it doesn't just pass through you. I've read that it's stored in your fat, and then it can go into causing different health, you know, issues, you know, one of them being cancer. It just sounds like you're both kind of very much supporting, you know, both of these things, Splenda and aspartame, and I just want to just hear if you have anything else to add to the conversation about, you know, it being not healthy or okay. What.
Well, Bethany, thanks for the question, and I'll be quite frank. I'm a chemist, so I think all chemicals are equal. There's a range of chemicals that are extremely deadly. Cyanide is a chemical, and yeah. It's very natural. I can pick it up off the earth, out of the soil. So that being said, though, Bethany, I think you do raise a good question about the safety of these ingredients and their evaluation. I think, and to that point, I think that one thing that's really fundamental to science and the science of food and the science of nutrition is the fact that we actually kind of don't know everything. I'll be quite frank with you. Right, just recently, the dietary guidelines came out and changed that we were not to. Fats now are not as deleterious as we thought they always were, and sugar now seems to be an issue. And I know I was drinking a can of cola at the time that said made with real sugar now. So it's interesting how the marketing side of things and the health side of things may be out of sync. But the reality is, I think, you know, the long term study of these types of ingredients is of key importance, and I think. There is some evidence showing out there that artificial sweeteners may have some issues with the hormones in the body and the manner in which we perceive sweetness and the manner in which we perceive satiety. But I would say, for me, as a scientist, I would say I'm willing to have that conversation and look at the evidence. Ultimately, it's the evidence that I'd like to see. So a paper that says that Splend or sucralose concentrates in the fatty tissue, I'd like to see that paper and see how they did that.
Okay.
More than anything. So I do think it's a debate, and I think that's good to keep debating it.
And we'll get right back to the phones in a second. But you mentioned having a Coke or a soda that had pure sugar.
Yes.
Explain quickly, so I can get back to the phones, why the concern about high fructose corn syrup as opposed to soda. And you see a lot of these sodas that say,
Now with real sugar. So that is still very sort of debatable. I think that there is some evidence that high fructose corn syrup affects the hormones in the body, leptin, and these different types of hormones that govern sort of nutritional processes. And I'm not an expert in that. To me, as a chemist, I think that both of these ingredients provide a perception of sweetness. I know why high fructose corn syrup is used. There are certain manufacturing and industrial advantages to this. It's not as hygroscopic. It doesn't pick up water, so it's easier to store. It's easier to ship. There's a lot of sort of economic sides to why you would use that. But in terms of the health side of it, I do think it's still being debated. But I do know now that it seems sugar is the thing. Sugar is now everything's going to be made with real sugar.
It's always been the thing. Mary Kate and Troy. Mary Kate, you're up.
Hi. You love the show.
Thank you.
My question is, have you been diagnosed with osteopenia?
Mary Kate, can you speak up, or is the phone in a shoe or something? Okay, let's try it again. Okay.
Well, there we go.
Ah, wow. You hurt my head. All right, let's try it again.
It was on speaker. I've been diagnosed with sort of a periosteoporosis and told to increase the amount of soy that I eat. And I was just wondering what the chemical relationship is between soy products and bone density, and if there's any other way other than soy. I'm not allergic to it, but I'm not crazy about it. And, you know, any other ways to improve bone density?
That's a very good question, Mary Kate. I've spent many years working on soy as an ingredient. I actually am allergic to it, so I don't like it at all. It's okay, whatever. We all have our own genetic destiny.
Yeah, you're on cross to bear.
Yes.
Right.
So I really don't like eating anything with soy in it. But that being said, soy, of course, as a source of nutrients, is very dense. You got a lot of protein there. You got various minerals, and vitamins, and oils. And carbohydrates, so it is sort of a very sort of rich and healthy seed. Now, to speak further to that, I really am not a medical person, so I don't want to sort of wade into that conversation because I just honestly don't have an answer to you. I know that soy certainly has health benefits. I know there have been some challenges with soy as well. I don't know if I'd, other than saying that soy is very healthy for you, I would sort of back away from that question. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry, Mary-Kate.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend. Over to Tracy in Cobleskill. Tracy, you're on with Dr. You're not a doctor, professor?
No, professor. Let's call me a professor.
You play one on the food channel. Yeah. Ted Russin is our guest. You're on, Tracy.
They
go ahead.
They used to call me doctor or professor sometimes.
Nice.
I was a brewer for 20 years.
Ooh.
Earlier, you were talking about the taste of umami.
Yes.
And that maybe that's part of what we can taste when we have fresh baked bread or something
yeah.
like that.
Yes.
And in my career, I was trying to learn about melanoidins.
Okay.
And so you did say something about amino acids mm-hmm. with umami.
Yes.
And that's a part of the melanoid Maillard reaction,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
too.
Yep.
That's where we get toasty, roasty,
yep, yep.
et cetera,
mm-hmm.
or burnt.
Yes.
And do we really taste umami or...
I think, you know...
Or how do we taste these melanoidins?
Tracy, that's an awesome, awesome question. I'm really... This is great. We're getting people calling in about the Maillard reaction and actually using the different sort of stages of the Maillard reaction.
We have very smart listeners.
This is public radio.
Yeah, exactly.
So melanoidins are, and thanks, Tracy, because they are sort of when we brown something. So say you sear a piece of meat, the formation of the brown surface has to do with the development of brown pigments, which are known as melanoidins. And those melanoidins, they are polymeric, so that means that they are not simply small molecules, but they are larger molecules, polymers of both sugars and amino acids. And there's a ton of chemical changes that happen when you sear a piece of meat. As you know, Tracy, the Maillard reaction is really, really complicated. To that point, I think that definitely they'd have an effect on color perception. They are sort of known for the color that we see when we brown something. And that could be anything from milk powder that you leave sort of under your bed for 5 years, turns brown eventually. Why you'd leave milk powder under your bed, that's your choice.
Not sure.
But, you know, these things don't have to happen. They don't have to happen in a fry pan, but they certainly do happen. So I would say that melanoidins, I don't know much about the sensory attributes and properties of melanoidins. I don't know if they're perceived as bitter or if they're perceived as sweet or whatever it may be. I know with regards to umami perception, umami is very complicated, and some people still sort of debate what the true essence of it is. I know the perception of glutamic acid or glutamates is sort of key for that taste perception, and I'm making differentiating taste between from flavor, because flavor involves aroma, so umami is really not an aroma. So I think that during the Maillard reaction, how many products are produced? I think that I wouldn't go out on a ledge and say the melanoidins are the source of umami flavors, but I'm certain they're part of that complex symphony that is we know as sort of a nice brown crust piece of bread.
All right, you guys all done now? Because that was very confusing for those of us who have no idea what you're talking
about. That was awesome. This is public
you like
radio.
That one? Okay,
yeah.
Ted enjoyed that. Tracy, thanks for the call. Let's go to Willie in Schenectady. Top that one, Willie, if you will.
Yes, I understand that the biological technique is now available where food type A can give you the benefits of food type B. In other words, I can have some key lime pie, a brownie, and a scoop of ice cream and get the same nutritional value of a steak, potato, and broccoli.
That sounds excellent.
Is this the Jetsons or something?
This
we got a pill?
Excellent.
All
excellent.
Right.
Well, you know, Willie, to be quite frank with you, you know, there would be carbohydrates and proteins present that would be found in your key lime pie that would be similar in nature to those found in your other foods the healthy foods, the broccoli or whatever it may be. I know there are some chefs, I'll tell you this, about a dish at a restaurant in England. Heston Blumenthal is this 3 Michelin-starred chef, and he's a superstar and a modernist cuisine. He's a scientist in the kitchen, and he has this dish called meat fruit, and it's a pâté that's shaped to look like an orange, and then he covers it with a citrus gel using sort of the rinds of oranges, and this is a 3 Michelin-starred restaurant, so they put little dimples on the outside of this orange gel so it looks like an orange.
Oh, terrific.
But it tastes like pâté.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so that idea of at least the manner of presenting something, having one presentation but looks like another, clearly an orange has a certain nutritional composition, and pâté has a different one, but, you know, it's all the same as we're eating it.
Willie, thanks a lot for that call, and we appreciate it. All right, let's clear up an email here. Here's one that says, and we only have about 30 seconds left, what is the actual danger in eating too much fast food? Are there dangerous secret ingredients being used by fast food companies to get us hooked? You have 30 seconds to answer that.
Awesome. Awesome. This is it's not controversial in
no,
any way.
No,
no. The reality is, I think fast food, I think anybody that makes good food If it's good food, there's something in there that's hooking you. Okay, I've talked earlier of my mother's roast chicken, and there was the fat and the age of the chicken and the crust in the skin and the succulence of the meat, and that's good stuff, and I'll tell you, I'm hooked on that.
Oh, that's a cop-out, man. You're a shill for the establishment, man.
I'm a shill
You're
for
covering
my,
it up.
I'm a shill for my mom's chicken.
All right.
But to that point, then, you know, when it comes to fast food, I don't think it's I think anybody that makes good food is trying to make good food, no matter what. Whether it's fast food in a paper bag or whether it's in a... I'm not going to discriminate against those molecules.
Okay, well, listen. I'm going to let you off the hook because we're out of time.
Okay.
Ted, good job. And we'll look forward to you. Hopefully they'll pick up that show and then we'll see Geekalicious.
It's good.
It's good stuff.
It was good.
Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Schenectady Green Market, a community marketplace providing fresh local produce and artisan goods downtown every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. inside Proctor's, schenectadygreenmarket.org. Ackerman's Appliance, Hudson. For 37 years, a locally owned dealer of appliance brands such as Sub-Zero, Wolf, Blue Star, Bosch, and more. Showroom on Warren Street, ackermansappliance.net. Cafe Capriccio, offering dining and catering with Tuscan cuisine in Albany, New York, and Neapolitan cuisine in Saratoga Springs. CafeCapriccio.com for reservations. And Godfrey Financial Associates, Latham, New York, celebrating 20 years of providing retirement planning and wealth management services for baby boomers and beyond. An independent, woman-owned financial advisory firm, GodfreyFinancial.com. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Barb King. That's right. That was you, Barb. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Have a great weekend.